Well, good morning to all. We'll get this out a little more balanced out here in a moment. So, we're in Mark chapter 6, and we'll hopefully get into chapter 7 in our study in the Gospel of Mark. Hope everybody has enjoyed their extra hour of sleep or partying, whatever it was you did with your hour. Hopefully nobody showed up an hour early for church. Shall we begin with a word of prayer this morning? Father, we're so grateful for your great kindness toward us and your patience, your mercy. At this time, we're mindful of the fact that you have revealed a portion of your mind to us as we study the Gospel of Mark, that we may be further impressed with who Jesus is and what he came to do. Not just for the world at large and all of the great things that he accomplished, but as we look into our own hearts to see what he can do for us, to be our Lord and Master, to change and transform us. In some ways, Father, must be the greatest miracle of all. And for that, we are thankful that you love us enough that you would have us to be your children and to come and be with you. We pray to that end, Father, you would bless our study, our time to be together, to encourage one another and to help each one better understand what you have said, and that we might be better people. In Christ we pray, and amen. All right, well, I think we got down basically to verse 30 of chapter 6 with the rehearsal of the execution of John. So we're in this third section of the first half of the book, and I've chosen this, "Do You Not Understand?" kind of is the theme of this section, and that'll become apparent as we get further into chapter 6 here. And then as we break down this third section, we've looked at the, again, each section beginning with some kind of calling or commissioning of the disciples, and that happened here as well, verses 14 through 29, where the subject of the beheading of John the Baptist came up. But the real point of all of that was, who is Jesus, and how really everything John did pretty much pointed to Jesus. His teaching pointed to Jesus, the circumstances of his birth foreshadowed those of Jesus, and here the circumstances of his death foreshadow that of Christ. And so now beginning in verse 30, we start these three miracle cycles or sections, and this kind of interlude that separates them with the Pharisees and the disciples. And so we're going to start that by looking at the feeding of the 5,000, and then that's followed by one of the walking on the sea stories and one of these kind of more general conclusions about the various healings that Jesus was doing at Gennesaret. So let's pick up in verse 30, and this is a story, of course, that's very familiar probably to a lot of people, even who aren't that really familiar with the Bible. It is the one miracle that's found in all four gospel accounts, not counting the resurrection, of course, but the things that Jesus did as he was in his earthly ministry. And this is the one that's recorded in all four, which raises an interesting question. What use do each of the gospel writers make of this story? And, for example, in John 6, you see how John takes the story and uses it to provide the background to Jesus' sermon in the synagogue at Capernaum that he's the bread of life, and drawing kind of on that theme of it. I think we'll see Mark makes a little bit different use of that, which is hinted at in chapter 6, but it won't really become apparent to us till we get to chapter 8. So the apostles gathered together with Jesus. They reported to him all that they had done and taught. So this is picking up where we had sent the disciples out earlier in that commissioning of the disciples, where he sent them out by two. And they have now come back and reported. He said to them, "Come away by yourselves to a lonely place and rest a while," for there were many people coming and going. They did not even have time to eat. They went away in the boat to a lonely place by themselves, and the people saw them going, and many recognized them, and they ran there together on foot from all the cities and got there ahead of them. And when he went ashore, he saw a great multitude, and he felt compassion for them because they were like sheep without a shepherd, and he began to teach them many things. And when it was already quite late, his disciples came up to him and began saying, "The place is desolate. It's already quite late. Send them away that they may go into the surrounding countryside and villages and buy themselves something to eat." But he answered and said to them, "You give them something to eat." And they said to him, "Shall we go and spend 200 denarii on bread and give them something to eat?" And he said, "Well, how many loaves do you have? Go look." And when they found out, they said, "Five and two fish." And he commanded them all to recline by groups on the green grass, and they reclined in companies of hundreds and fifties. And he took the five loaves and the two fish, and looking up toward heaven, he blessed the food and broke the loaves, and he kept giving them to the disciples to set before them. And he divided up the two fish among them all. They all ate and were satisfied, and they picked up 12 full baskets of the broken pieces and also of the fish. And there were 5,000 men who ate the loaves. All right, so first I'll just kind of open it up and see what observations you might want to make from this story. Charlie? Yeah, you wonder how much they even had on them. I mean, that would be a significant amount of money. I mean, it'd be like among us right here now, do we have, you know, 7 months worth of cash, you know, in our pockets, you know, I don't know, 20,000 bucks or whatever. Be kind of, a conservative estimate. Well, I could put that on a credit card, but I'd just be in really big trouble next month, right? So whether that's all they had, and even if we hadn't spent that, of course, that wouldn't really be enough for everybody. I think that's implied here. It's stated in the other gospel accounts, and not even enough to get everybody a crumb, you know, very little. Of course, Jesus here seems to be testing the disciples. John tells us quite explicitly it's Jesus' intention to test them. And that he particularly targets Philip and says, "Philip, where can we go and get enough bread for these people?" And Philip should have said, "Well, to whom shall we go? You are the bread of life. You can provide all things. You're the creator," and so on. "Command these stones to be made bread," and it would be so. Now, what Jesus might have said to him at that point, get behind me, so. Colleen? God will provide. Sure. Yeah. Right. Yeah, get into panic mode. Yeah, I can cast out demons, but I can't feed a hungry person. You know, because I don't know what it is, because it is human nature. You know, people, you know, a madman could burst in here with a gun and put it to your head and say, "Renounce Christ or I'm going to shoot you." And I suspect many of us would be able to say, "Well, you're just going to have to shoot because I'm not going to renounce the Lord." But then, you know, I might be, you know, over on campus and someone leaves their door unlocked and I wander in and take a $10 bill off their desk, you know. It's like, it's just something about that, you know. But people do that. We fail in little ways when, you know, we have the gumption to stand up in big ways sometimes. And you know, it's just part of the inconsistency of our life.
It's very interesting to watch this, you know, with Saul's writers,
Right, yeah, if you go back and reread the Old Testament, knowing who Jesus is, and once he's been vindicated, his claims that he is the Messiah and so on. So you do read a passage like Psalm 23, the Lord is my shepherd, and I don't lack anything, and he'll provide. Since we're on that, I would mention, again, verse 39, the green grass that Nathan mentioned a couple weeks ago in our study on Wednesday. And as he mentioned, the word green is not found very often. When it is found, for example, in Revelation, it's the color of death. You know, it's not a good thing there. And that's where the most translations say something like a pale horse or something, but it's a green horse. But it's the greenness of, you know, death. I mean, it's always been perceived to kind of be the pallor of the dead. You can see this with Egyptian tomb paintings where the, you know, Osiris, the god of the dead, is painted with a green tone to him and so on. But here, I don't think this is, you know, green grass is not dead grass. That's not the point here. But that does bring to mind the green pastures, or at least it can. It's one of the few places your mind can go to, scripturally, so to speak. And when you connect that with the sheep without a shepherd and the overall theme of God providing for his people, and clearly the point here is not God is merely able to provide for your physical needs, whatever spiritual needs there are, even more so, more importantly. Nathan? Right, and I think a good example of that is the parable of the unmerciful servant in Matthew 18. You know, guy's forgiven a huge debt. Well, of course, I can't pay that back. That's astronomical. But this guy who owes me some chump change, he can pay that back, and he better, you know. And I do think it is that notion of what's within our power, what we can do. You know, I can take care of myself with this, this, and this, and this, but and I only need God or bother God for the big things. But it is this constant awareness of our utter dependence upon God for everything. You know, if I want to keep living, I should keep breathing. And so I take a breath and I say, good job, Tom. You took a good breath there. Now you're going to live for another few seconds. Well, it's not me, you know. I mean, there's work involved. My body has to cooperate. But ultimately, any breath I take is a free gift from God. But how often do we stop and think about that? You know, we don't tend to. Because, you know, that pagan out there, he's breathing too, and he gives no thought to God. He benefits from God's blessings. And so it's really that recognition and that acknowledgement of God and thankfulness toward God that distinguishes us from the pagan who refuses to acknowledge God. And we ought to remember that, of course. Anything else catch your attention in this story? Adam? Yes, I mean, kind of like I think Colleen was suggesting, if they had been sent out by Jesus with the power to heal and to cast out demons, then maybe they could have understood that they could have had the ability, if they had called upon it or trusted in the Lord or whatever, to provide for them. You know, there's two possibilities. I guess you could say Jesus knows good and well they can't do it, and he's taunting them. You know, like, you know, you give your remedial math class an advanced, you know, calculus 3 differential equation test. Here, pass this test and you can pass the course. Ha 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 ha. You give them something neat. Yeah, we'll see how this works. You know, I don't think that doesn't strike me as who Jesus would be. But, you know, here's a problem. How would you solve it? What would you do about this? And because they aren't thinking with above thinking, they're more thinking of below in this world, you know, where do you go, what stores open, how much it's going to cost, you know, those kind of worldly ways of solving the problem, they're not able to. Certainly. Charlie? Well, yeah, I think there's more to it than that, certainly. there seems to be something particular about the disciples, and I think that's what Adam was getting at. Jesus' challenge to them, or his explicit testing of Philip in John's account, you deal with this problem. And the question isn't just God is the ultimate source of all good. I mean, you could have said, well, you know, the disciples saying, let's go to Publix and buy 200 denarii worth of bread, that'll solve the problem. And it comes from God, because God's working through Publix to provide food for people. I mean, you could argue that, and there wouldn't be anything particularly wrong about that. I mean, I'm not going to go home and just sit there and expect God miraculously is going to make food appear, you know, before me on my plate without any effort on my part. So I think here the focus really is on the disciples and their preparation and equipping for the work that God is calling them to do. If we look in verse 41, when Jesus, you know, he takes the bread, he blesses the food. And again, that's one of those words people get kind of tripped up on, because, you know, we have the Lord's Supper. Are we supposed to ask the blessing or give the blessing? And people feel awkward because, well, I'm not God. How can I give a blessing? Well, it's a word that's used of both God and man. When God speaks favorably, he bestows a favor upon us. And that's how we normally think of the word blessing. When man speaks well in regard to God, it can only be to thank him. And so it's a word that means to give thanks. And so Jesus took the bread, he gave thanks for it, he broke it, and then gave it to them. And there's one other story that will occur here in chapter 8, the feeding of the 4,000, where Jesus will take the bread and he will give thanks and he will break it and he will give it to them. And there's obviously going to be parallels there with the 4,000 that are fed, and how these are really in a Gentile territory compared to the Jewish territory here. That may be part of the difference going on there. But there's one final story in the gospel, of course, where Jesus will take and give thanks and break and give, and that's going to be what? Yeah, the Lord's Supper. And I think that probably accounts for some of the significance with which this story was read and understood and included in all the Gospels. It, in some way, is a foreshadowing of the same thing the Lord's Supper is a shadow of, and that is that great banquet that God has prepared for us for eternity. And so with the provision of our food here is not, as wonderful as that is, and our physical lives depend on it, that itself is just a object lesson of a greater point, which is God provides what we really need, which are those spiritual things that will last eternally. And we need to look to him for the source of that, and ultimately, you know, Jesus is that for us. Yeah, 50s or hundreds. Yeah, you know, that could be one of those details, an eyewitness noticed and remembered, and it's kind of more window dressing. Do you really see a lot of symbolic significance to that. Some people have suggested, of course, the companies of 50s and 100s is, a model by which military units are organized. And so, is there some suggestion here of this is, God's army, which if you go that route, obviously it's not equipping them for actual physical battle with the Romans or something.
One of the things I've come across in preparing for the Wednesday night class is that this is one of those things that's getting sometimes thinking, there's no way it was really 5,000 people. Sometimes you see a big crowd, you're like, oh, this is thousands of people. Really, it was like,
right.
76, and it looked like a lot of people because of the size of the building. this is the kind of detail that gives credence to the number of people, because you've got 50 groups of 100 people. It's pretty easy to pin down exactly how many people there are. And they're fishermen, but you've got at least one pack of blood.
Well, maybe. now you see where the number 5,000 came from. They took the 50 and the 100 and multiplied it together, and that's okay. I'm sorry. That's really bad. Dan.
You see that the disciples did exactly what Jesus told them to. You give them something to eat, And so we have the Jesus is the one that has the blessing for the people, and the disciples deliver to the people, which is a
right. Yeah, he emphasizes that Jesus gave the food to the disciples, and they're the ones that distributed it to the people there in verse 41. Jeremy?
Yeah, I had a footnote in verse 40 when he's sitting down by hundreds and fifties to Exodus when Moses is dividing up the people after Jethro told him it's not good for you to judge people alone, and it's by thousands, hundreds, and fifties. It says that a couple times.
Okay.
So I don't know if that would be alluding back to Moses there.
Right.
By mentioning that there's a
right. Right. and while we're going back to the Old Testament, of course, Elisha works a similar miracle back in 2 Kings chapter 4, where they're like, 20 loaves of bread, and he feeds 100 people with it. And so that's, extraordinary, but not, here we have many fewer loaves and a much larger number of people. So, it's even a bigger miracle by comparison.
Is there any significance to the number of loaves and the number of fish? Because I noticed in chapter 8, it's 7 loaves and little fish.
Right. Unknown number of, fish. That's typically what these are. I mean, if you're picturing like a couple largemouth bass or something, that's probably not what it is. This was a kind of like a pickled fish relish thing, and the purpose wasn't. I mean, obviously, even one person wouldn't feed them. I'm full now. I had those two little fish, but it was more like a flavoring to put on your bread to, give it some more. More than just dry bread you're eating, kind of thing. Kind of like putting butter on it or, something like that. Although fish and butter aren't anywhere in the same category as far as I'm concerned. But some people are into that kind of thing. That's more power to them. So, but that seemed to be the purpose. So the bread would be the main portion of the meal. Now, again, I know various people have speculated, but I don't know of anything that kind of you can seize on it with any kind of certainty. The five loaves are the five books of Moses. It's any five you find in the Bible, people will suggest there's some connection with that. So the five and the seven makes the 12, and then you've got the 12 disciples or the 12 tribes of Israel. So it just oh, okay. Yeah. That was a fishy comment there. So okay. Anything else on this particular text? Now, as we'll see, notice in verse 52, after the situation with the walking on the water, they were greatly astonished, For they had not gained any insight from the incident of the loaves, but their heart was hardened. And this is really the point that Mark and Matthew also will draw from the both stories of the feeding of the 5,000 and the 4,000. And this will come up in chapter 8. They'll be in a boat again. Jesus will say, "Watch out for the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod." And they'll say, "Oh, we didn't bring any bread. He's getting on to us because we forgot to bring some bread along. You know, if he gets peckish on the voyage here, we're going to be in big trouble, you know." And of course, Jesus knows what they're, you know, discussing amongst themselves. And, you know, how in the world are you guys talking about physical bread? Do you not understand what's going on here? You know, verse 18 of chapter 8, "Having eyes, do you not see? Having ears, do you not hear? Do not remember when I broke the five loaves for the 5,000 and the seven for the 4,000. And he asked them, you know, "How many baskets did you fill up?" And of course, they know the answer because they were there. And then he says in verse 21, "Do you not yet understand?" And so again, that's kind of the theme of this section. They don't understand. They don't fully grasp what the mission and purpose of Jesus is. And so it's being revealed to them. We, with hindsight, can see it more easily than they could at the time. But their hearts are hardened. They don't understand. And it's going to take something extraordinary to change their thinking about that. And in fact, that's really ultimately what the resurrection will do. You know, they're not going to be truly changed until that happens. Right. Well, that's a good question. I haven't really thought about that here in the context of, I guess I've kind of assumed before the events of chapter 7 unfold. But
I presume it's after the miracles of 53 through 56.
Yes. Yeah. I think the incident with the boat, you get that. In John 6 as well, and then it's following that they make it to Capernaum, and he preaches in the synagogue there. You know, that kind of thing. So, all right. Well, let's move on to the walking on the water story. Immediately, which again doesn't always mean as immediately as we like to think sometimes, but pretty quickly after this. He made his disciples get into the boat and go ahead of him to the other side to Bethsaida, while he himself was sending the multitude away. And after bidding them farewell, he departed to the mountain to pray. When it was evening, the boat was in the midst of the sea. He was alone on the land. Seeing them straining at the oars, for the wind was against them, at about the fourth watch of the night, he came to them walking on the sea, and he intended to pass by them. But when they saw him walking on the sea, they supposed it was a ghost and cried out, for they all saw him and were frightened, but obviously didn't recognize him. But immediately he spoke with them and said to them, "Take courage, it is I," or "I am, do not be afraid." And he got into the boat with them, and the wind stopped, and they were greatly astonished, for they had not gained any insight from the incident of loaves, for their heart was hardened. So, some interesting, I guess, again, a lot of us are familiar with the basics of this story. Disciples in the boat, Jesus comes walking on the water to them. And again, they're astonished by this. It is a miracle. But what are we to make of this? And there's some interesting details Mark gives us here that catch your attention, certainly. We should have color-coded Bibles to specifically point all that out. But certainly one of the things, end of verse 48, he intended to pass by them. What does that sound like? Charlie? Oh, like the destroying angel passed by them. Be an interesting connection. Okay. Or are you thinking of Moses or Elijah? Okay, Elijah was, but you could, you know, think of both. Back in Exodus 33-34, where Moses wanted to see God's glory, and then God hides him in the cleft of the rock, and he passes by him and pronounces his name. And then, of course, that happens at Mount Sinai. And then, you know, sometime later, you have Elijah. He goes to Mount Sinai. This is in 1 Kings 19, after his victory over the prophets of Baal. And Jezebel, of course, wants to kill him, and he's kind of wallowing in his self-pity, I guess you might say. And he flees to Mount Sinai, and like Moses, he goes 40 days without eating anything. You remember the angel had shown up and gave him a, quite literally, an angel food cake. And in the strength of that food, he lasted for 40 days. And he goes to Mount Sinai, and there he's hiding, and that's where the wind, you know, comes by, but God's not in the wind, and there's this great earthquake, and God's not in the earthquake, and then there's this great fire, and God's not in the fire. And then there is this, what many translations will say, the small voice, right? And then God's in that whispering voice or something like that. The problem with that is you could also translate that a devastating thunder. And now those are two quite different things, right? And you just wonder, well, that's Hebrew for you. Because the word for noise or voice is kol, which is also the word that's used of thunder. And you say, well, how do you know? Well, your context, you know, that's what tells you which. It's just a word for sound. So what kind of sound is it? And the other word that's modifying it is to make small. And so those who take it as a whispery, small, still voice, take that to mean the sound is small, like God's just whispering. And you can see that preaches, you know. God has manifest himself in these terrifying pyrotechnical kinds of displays, but God's not in that. He's in this, you know, small thing. And so you don't despise the day of small things, that type of thing. But on the other hand, God is very often manifest with thunder, as well as the wind and the quaking of the earth and the fire. And the point could, and of course those things are just overwhelming, you know. And this sound, this thunder, this voice of God is so devastating. It's reducing things to rubble, you know, making things small, like pulverizing them. And that would be the way that some take it. I don't know there are too many translations that adopt that, because we have the small, still voice tradition, and, you know, you don't want to upset the apple cart too much with some people. But there have been some that have suggested that. So it's just intriguing to think about. And the point would not be how loud or big or whatever the thing was, but the fact that God speaks with his voice. That's how God communicates, you know, and so it's about what God has to say, not, you know, some big to-do. But anyway, that's a study for 1 Kings 19. But God does pass by and disclose himself or manifest himself to Elijah and to Moses. And so, I mean, if Jesus was just wanting to sneak by them, I'm sure he could have easily done that, you know, like he didn't want to be seen. I'm just going to pass by. I'm going to slip by, you know. Clearly, he intends to come to them and test them again, very similar to what we had with the feeding of the 5,000. And we'll see how they respond to that. But once again, they really fail the test because their hearts are hardened and they don't have understanding yet about who exactly, Jesus is. Now, when we think about the miracle itself of walking on water, just like we saw with the feeding of the 5,000, you've got, a fourth of the number of loaves, and you got 50 times the number of people. And so Jesus' miracle just way outdoes Elisha's multiplying of bread to feed those 100 prophets. In the same way, you have a really small handful of water stories in the Old Testament of people having power over water like this. And so, which ones come to mind? Okay, Moses parting the Red Sea, right? Well, that seems to be a whopper. Okay, the Jordan River, and so there you can think of Joshua as the heir of Moses, where the priests, step into the Jordan River and it parts and they walk across on dry land. And then another parting took place with, again, Elijah and Elisha. Remember, Elijah's on his way to catch his fiery chariot. And he strikes the water and it separates and crosses over. And when Elisha receives Elijah's mantle, after Elijah leaves and he comes back, he does the same thing, which indicates that he has received the same power as Elijah had. So you've got these individuals who have shown that God is working through them to have this same kind of power of parting water and walking across on dry land, but we don't have anybody walking on water. You don't even need to bother parting the water. That's an extraneous step for God. He can walk on water, right? And that's what Job 9 says. God is called the one who treads the waters. And so that might, you think back to creation, where God had that kind of power over the waters and so on. So clearly, that you're pointing to Jesus in a very extraordinary kind of way here. Oh, no, go ahead. Good.
Okay, he saw that they were strengthened.
Or providentially, a wind that was hindering them, anyway.
So then he goes and is walking on the water. So even though he knew they were strengthened, he went out there just to, like, pass them by.
Right.
What is that about?
Right. Yeah. So what was Jesus intending to do? What should they have thought? In an ideal world, if the disciples were not hard-hearted and they had full understanding, what should have happened? I guess that's how we
master
could.
Help us.
Master, help us.
This is not the first time we've seen him with them on the water, and there was a problem. Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. We had the stilling of the storm, back in chapter 4. Right. In fact, I think we'll go back to the end of chapter 4. This is verses 36 through 41. This is where they're in the boat and there's a storm. And you remember the question that was asked, the very last thing we're left with at the end of that story is, who is this that even the wind and sea obey him? And that question's not answered, right? And now we come to a boat story where we kind of get the answer to the question, and the answer is, I am, right? And it's one of those things, again, where in ordinary speech, it could be just, hey, guys, it's me, not a ghost here, just your regular out for a walk on the Sea of Galilee kind of guy, average Joe. I don't think that's, it clearly takes on greater overtones here, and that I am is the name of God back from the time of Moses. And so you think again, God revealed himself to Moses as the I am, as well as passing by him and declaring himself to be Yahweh, Yahweh God, compassionate and gracious, slow to anger, full of grace and truth, and so on. And now Jesus is passing by the disciples and revealing himself to be the same God, the I Am, and the one who, again, to say he controls the waters just seems so mundane of God, but all that it represents. And again, if we think of water to the ancients as being particularly the symbol of chaos and death, and God even treads upon death, and God is in control of all the chaos, and he will bring order and restore all things the way it's supposed to be. So, a story that, as a kid growing up, you know, you read the story, and Jesus will walk on water. Yeah, he can do that kind of thing, but you don't really get any real significance out of that. Like, you know, it really seems to be hinting. All right, we got several hands here. Nathan first. Okay, Charlie. Yeah, and I think very clearly the allusion to that in chapter 8 is making a connection there with that. That they don't see, they don't understand, right?
It's weird that he uses the word, you know, their hearts were hardened.
Right.
Normally when you hear that phrase, it's because either the devil has hardened or, you know, such as Pharaoh, where he's done himself.
Right.
He sees, he understands, but he doesn't.
Right, right.
I think it's interesting that Mark doesn't talk about the instead of Peter coming out to see Jesus. But the emphasis here is on Jesus.
Right.
And the other gospels say, now Peter came out of the boat, and that's a pretty significant event, you'd think. You mentioned that.
Right.
But I think what we're talking about is really the point. You know, we're focusing on Jesus' power here, and that's a concern.
Right. Our time is slipping away from us here, unfortunately. last part of this, when they had crossed over, they came to land at Gennesaret, moored to the shore. When they had come out of the boat, immediately the people recognized him, ran about that whole country, and began to carry about on their pallets those who were sick to the place where they heard he was. And wherever he entered villages or cities or countryside, they were laying the sick in the marketplaces and entreating him that he might just touch the fringe of his cloak, and as many as touched it were being cured. And of course, you remember that from the woman back in chapter 5, who just wanted to touch his garment and was healed of her malady. And so here we find that in a broader scale of that happening. And you also see that in the book of Acts when, you know, Peter and Paul are able to heal people when just their shadow passes over them, or, you know, their garment touches them. And, you know, of course, that's led to all kinds of fake healers. You know, you send in your money and they'll send you a miracle cloth of some kind to, you know, touch yourself with, and you'll be healed of your sickness or something. But that misses the point of what, you know, how these miracles, again, are signs that are pointing to Jesus. So this is really just a summary statement that indicates, kind of like John will say explicitly, Jesus did a lot of things and could tell you in detail about all of them. So you ought to know what's going on, but not to, you know, hash out each one of these events that are taking place. And that probably sets the stage then for the kind of rising opposition that the religious authorities have to Jesus, which starts here then in chapter 7. And I hesitate to get started in that, but if I could, I could satisfy myself. We got into chapter 7, right? Anything else on chapter 6? Or
given the regularity of, you know, he tells people not to say anything about this miracle, they go do the exact opposite. He doesn't say that to the woman back in chapter 5, but do you think maybe the amount of people who were saying, let's just touch his garment, we'll be okay, that her story got out, and she went out and told people?
Right, yeah. Something gave them the idea. Either they independently got it the same way she did, or, you know, she did it and word got out about that. So that's a good thought with that. Yeah, Colleen? Right. Right.
So there's some other aspect of
right. Yeah, it's not like they're irreligious. They're just devoted to, you know, drug abuse and theft and, you know, all kinds of immorality or something. So good point. Dan, did you have a...
Yeah, I think the answer to that is that Jesus was intending to pass by him. He wanted them to recognize him. You see, in contrast, when they get out of the boat, the people immediately recognize him. Mm. They didn't recognize him for who he was.
Okay? Right.
And the people did totally, but they should have had a better recognition. The right. base root of that word is knowledge.
Right.
Have a knowledge.
Well, and of course, the common people, on what basis they had to know who Jesus was very limited. Whereas these chosen disciples had been with Jesus and should have learned something. You know, would Jesus have... I mean, we know in John chapter 6, Jesus gets on to the people for, they only saw the sign in the sense of filling their belly, but they didn't really gain any understanding beyond that. But Jesus is upbraiding the disciples for a failure to understand that really goes beyond that level of lack of understanding. And that'll probably come up again in chapter 8, but it does seem, it's kind of like John will say in John chapter 7, even Jesus' brothers did not believe in him. But I think it's pretty obvious they thought he was the Messiah. You know, they were trying to help him and give him some advice about, you know, go to Jerusalem and, you know, get some good PR and be somebody. But it was their understanding of what kind of Messiah he really was. And I think on some level that must be what is going on with these disciples, that they're so caught up in their preconceived idea about what the Messiah is that they're very resistant to listening to what Jesus is actually saying and understanding the full implication, because that's going to strip away all of their what they believe in and destroy that and rebuild it, right? And so I think that's really where the hard-heartedness comes in. So just preconceived ideas, you know. Like we've read a passage our whole life a certain way and always understood it a certain way, and we're not being bad people. You know, but we're hard-hearted because we're not allowing the Word to actually speak to us the way it really is, right? All right, we'll have to stop there and let the kids in and...